The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Pat Williams Power Hour, AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word. This is your hour when Orlando Magic Senior Vice President Pat Williams sits down and speaks with authors who've written books on topics of interest and insight for listeners like you. And now, here's your host, Pat Williams.
Well, folks, it's time for this Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. We get together like this every weekend. Right here on AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word in Orlando. So pleased you're with us. And so is Pete Paquette. He's our engineer. Andrew Hurd Liska produces the show. And I want to present to you Jeremiah Johnston. He's a pastor of apologetics, cultural engagement at Prestonwood Baptist Church in the Dallas, Texas area. And his book is out, Body of Proof: The Seven Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today. Jeremiah, welcome to Orlando. How are you?
Oh, Pat, it's so great to be back with you. Thank you for your wonderful welcome. I'm excited about our conversation. This is the Super Bowl week for Christians, isn't it? Holy Week? I mean, this is what it's all about.
Well, that's great. Tell me, Jeremiah, why this book was important for us to read and for you to write.
We are reminded this week especially that the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus, Pat, is the center of a Christian worldview. It's the center of our faith. Christians, it's so wonderful that our faith, which is the largest faith in the world, was launched, and it never should have been, because the disciples had given up. Their Messiah had been crucified. No one expected a resurrection. It took everyone by surprise. And what happened that first April Easter morning utterly transformed the world, and it continues to change the world. And the reason that I wrote my new book, Body of Proof, Pat, is after studying for years at Oxford and then seeing the power of the gospel, as you have, to change lives all over the world, I wanted to, with no prerequisites, in about 3.5 hours of reading, Pat, the reader will be fully up to date on the latest evidences that prove the resurrection of Jesus, but also the practical applications of how it changes our life today. And that's why I wrote it. And I'm delighted that, you know, the resurrection of Jesus is understudied, it's underpreached today. And I'm delighted that so many Christians are getting excited about this book, and they're giving it to people that are questioning Christianity or looking into it. So it's a great tool as well.
Jeremiah, let's dive into the meat of this book. The seven best reasons to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Reason number one, society is transformed everywhere Christianity is introduced and embraced.
It's remarkable when you study the impact of the Christian movement to improve the lives of the communities in which the gospel is embraced. We can look through the halls of history, and we can see that this notion of physical bodily resurrection caused Christians to care for people from the womb to the tomb, quite literally. In fact, so profound was the belief of Jesus' resurrection, Pat, a lot of people don't realize that the early Christians had to come up with a new word for burial. In the time of Jesus, you could be buried in a mausoleum, a sepulcher, or a memoriam. But Christians, because they believed they would rise again because of Jesus' resurrection, decided to be buried together. And this was innovative in the first century world. And they came up with a new term called dormitories or sleeping rooms. But let me give it to you in the Greek, koimeterion. It's transliterated cemetery. So we see a cemetery today when we drive by. We have no idea how that was innovated, it had to have been innovated by the Christian movement, because Christians who were buried together, they believed they would rise together. And that's just one of 100 different ways in which this proclamation that Jesus is alive, so we have hope, caused us to change the world.
Reason number two, Jesus called it on the third day. Expand on that.
Well, if the church had a hashtag, and by the way, if anyone's listening across Central Florida and you don't know what a hashtag is, we can't help you today. You just need to ask your grandkids or something, or your kids. But if the church had a hashtag, it was on the third day. There are scholars and skeptics apart that try to conclude that Jesus didn't really know what he was doing in his ministry, that people who came later made him God. In fact, Constantine, you know, they say all these crazy things. And what's important about Jesus' passion predictions, this is number two of the body of proof, Jesus predicted his death and his resurrection. Jesus loved to take Old Testament passages and apply them to himself, specifically here, Hosea 6, 2, and 3. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. Jesus takes that passage and he applies it to himself. He messianizes it. Mark 8:31, Mark 9:31, Mark 10:33 and 34. So Jesus was set on, he literally, as Luke says, set his face to the cross. The reason Jesus came was to give us forgiveness of sins and to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. And that's why his predictions are so important.
Now I want you to explain reason number three. Jesus demonstrated resurrection power.
There are 8 resurrections in the Bible. 3 are recorded in the Gospels. Jesus not only taught resurrection eschatologically, he not only predicted he would be raised from the dead, but number 3, it's very clear that he showed that he had power over death. Mark chapter 5, Jairus' daughter is raised from the dead. Luke chapter 7, Jesus literally stops a funeral processional, Pat. And by the way, that means the boy had died that day, so they would have been trying to bury him before nightfall. He stops the processional and says, the boy isn't dead, he's sleeping, and he raises him from the dead. And of course, John 11, the only place I see in the New Testament outside of Jesus's cry of dereliction on the cross where Jesus yells, and he yells at death, and he says, Lazarus, duro exo, come out, come forth. And Lazarus came forth. So Jesus not only predicted his resurrection, but point number 3 of the body of proof, he showed he had power over death.
It's time now to move to reason number 4. Our guest is Jeremiah Johnston, Body of Proof, the name of his book. No motivation to invent Jesus' resurrection narrative is evident.
This is the most important argument in the whole book, and this actually represents an original contribution to knowledge. If my wife and our 5 kids would never let me do another doctorate, but if I did, I would do it on this question right here. So I'm hoping others will pick up this argument for the faith and take it forward. You have to understand that if the disciples were trying to invent a religion and trying to come up with details that would be compelling to their audience, they did a terrible job. I mean, I'm talking to Pat Williams, a marketing genius right now, ladies and gentlemen, across Central Florida. And Pat, if you were trying to invent a religion, you would not have invented it the way the disciples did. You would have never had women be your main witnesses. Mary Magdalene, we only hear about her 1 time in the Gospels, and she's the first person to see Jesus alive. You would never have the embarrassing narrative that Peter was a cussing Christian and, you know, cussed and said he didn't know the man. And you wouldn't have the disciples running scared. They're just in the centerpiece of the argument. You would never, ever have your Messiah die on a cross, because we don't have anything that's an equivalent in our society. To die on a Roman cross was a heinous, shameful way to die. And so to invent a narrative with those details would have been a non-starter. Why did they start the story that way? Because that's what actually happened.
Reason number 5. Written and archaeological sources overwhelmingly support the gospel's resurrection narrative, you write.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. You know, this is for our friends and our family members who are like, well, how can you prove the resurrection to me without using your Bible? We all have people that try to tell us that, and that's fine. The cool thing about the Christian faith, it's based in evidence, so therefore archaeology is Christianity's closest cousin. And when you look at Jewish burial traditions, Pat, when you study the way that Jews kept track of their families and they were the family that was buried together, stays together, there are 150,000 bodies buried on the Mount of Olives alone. And when you look at other of the latest, I actually have two full chapters on archaeology related to the resurrection of Jesus specifically. It's really fascinating when you look at even the latest archaeological work that was done in 2017 at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It took 50 years to negotiate it. A lot of people don't realize, I know you know negotiations, Pat. A lot of people don't realize six different church denominations vie for a spot at the table when it comes to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And they opened the tomb for 60 hours in 2017, and all of it was first century. And this was National Geographic covering it, not a Christian magazine. And it was just fascinating. So I just hold the reader by the hand for two chapters and go through all of the archaeology of both Jewish burial traditions and also of the traditional sites. I talk about the Garden Tomb, and it will give them a full update that the Gospels get it right.
Reason number six, only Jesus' resurrection convincingly explains the conversion of people not previously his followers.
Pat, I don't know if you have a brother or not, but for those that are listening, I have four sons. Mm. And so there's a lot of brothers. And so you have to ask yourself, what would it take for you to believe your brother was the Son of God, the Messiah of the world? People always laugh about this because James did not believe his brother was the Messiah. He refused to believe it, in fact. John 7, verse 5, not even his brothers believed on him. Mark 3, 21, not even his family believed on him. They thought he was out of his mind, Mark 3, 21 says. So we have to ask ourselves, what changed? What changed Brother James to go from a skeptic to what Galatians 1 says, he's a pillar of the New Testament church, meaning he's like one of the head honchos? Well, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 7, shows us that Jesus appeared to his brother James. And I can often see that in my mind's eye, Pat. Like, he shows up at the, you know, the construction site. Remember, these guys were builders. And he's like, hey, bro, check it out. He appears before, but he says, check out my side, check out my hands. They really got me, but I'm alive now. And what do we know? We know that 32 years later, James dies in AD 62. He's stoned to death. We know this from the first century historian Josephus. He dies, and he's willing to be stoned to death, proclaiming his brother Jesus is the Messiah of the world.
My guest is Jeremiah Johnston. Speaking with us from Dallas, his book, Body of Proof. We have another segment with Jeremiah. Stay with us here on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. It's AM 990, FM 101.5, The Word in Orlando.
More of the Pat Williams Hour in just a moment. AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour. AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word. Now, here's Pat.
Jeremiah Johnston has written a marvelous book, an important book, Body of Proof, The Seven Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today. Jeremiah, reason number seven, Jesus' resurrection is the only basis for making sense of suffering. Explain.
You know, this is something that's very close to my heart, Pat, because some of the individuals who are listening to us right now, this may be their first Easter without a loved one. They might have experienced loss over the last year, suffering. We wonder, where's hope? And the beauty of the resurrection of Jesus is it shows us that our life has purpose. The resurrection of Jesus shows us that, as Paul says, the anchor verse for this point is Romans 8:18. For I compare that the sufferings of this world cannot compare with the joy and the glory that is to come. Paul could say that for one reason only, Pat. He could endure his sufferings. And remember, if you read 2 Corinthians, Paul had so much adversity that he didn't even believe he was a true apostle. Because how could you be apostle and have so many problems and challenges? So I can identify with that, and I'm sure many people listening to us can right now. And yet the key to our hope is the resurrection. We can endure it. We know that suffering had a beginning and suffering has an end in Jesus' name. And we also know that for those of our family members who have died in the Lord, we know that we can talk about them in the present tense. Not that they were or was, but they are. And though our family members who have died in Christ, they're more alive today than they've ever been in their entire life. 2 Corinthians 5:8. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And so when we talk about the practical application of Body of Proof, these seven proofs, we see an immediate one here that the resurrection of Jesus is the key to our endurance. It's the key to our perseverance. The Apostle Paul, after 57 magisterial verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, says, therefore, verse 58, therefore, be immovable, be strong, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. And so the truth of the resurrection will actually give us strength to face adversity.
Jeremiah, I want you to, your book actually breaks down into three parts, and we dove right into part three, the meat of your book. But in part four, the new frontier, further assessing the evidence. The most significant place in Christianity is one topic, and if the disciples invented the story of Jesus' resurrection, they did a terrible job. can you explain all that you've written?
Yes, thank you for asking. This is part four, and what's really cool is even though the subtitle says there are seven reasons, there's actually nine. I offer two additional really cool reasons to believe, substantiated, very persuasive, cogent reasons to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. And you know, you could stop the book after part three and you've got the meat of it, but it's almost like a video game. It's easy, normal, you know, and then hard. This is kind of gets into the new frontier. Like, hey, if I was geeking out in a Bible study, or if I was really wanting to push the ball down the field, I would definitely look into these two areas. And the chapter 11 is the most significant place in Christianity. And I talk about two of the proposed sites of where the resurrection of Jesus happened. And in only about 2,600 words, if memory serves, I'm able to guide the reader by the hand through the Garden Tomb, the pros and cons of that site, which is in Jerusalem as a potential spot. And then we also go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I give all of both the history of how the Church of the Holy Sepulchre became the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Oh, it goes all the way back to the second century when Jerusalem was demolished after the Bar Kokhba revolt. So it's fascinatingly old to think that that church has been known as the spot since the second century is pretty amazing. It's the right spot archaeologically and timing speaking. We have early eyewitness testimony. So we go through that. I find it just fascinating. In fact, on the cover of my book, there's actually a picture of the edicule. That's the little house or temple that's inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre with light shining down on it. I love this image. And then finally, the last chapter is a treatment on all of the things the gospel writers get wrong. If they were trying to come up with a marketable story about Jesus, but one that wasn't true. So I have a lot of fun with that. They literally offended everybody they could possibly offend, because that's the truth of what actually happened. And by offend, I mean Jesus appears to women. Women are the first witnesses. There's so many delicious details in the story that you would just never – you would never market those if you were a marketing genius, because you would just think those would not – gain traction in the culture of the day. And yet they did, because that's what actually happens.
Jeremiah, I am fascinated with your academic journey from Oxford to Jerusalem. Can you explain that to us?
I would love to, Pat. Thank you for the question. One thing that was very apparent to both my wife, Audrey, and myself was we were Christians, but I would not have thought of myself or described myself as a Christian thinker. I loved God with my heart, and I was trying to figure out how to love God with my mind. And for Audrey and me, that meant that we loaded up in 2009 and had a 12-week-old baby, and we moved to Oxford, England, and didn't know a soul. And I wanted to study the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus at the intellectual center that Oxford is. And I spent 3 years in a full-time PhD program in the city of Oxford and in the libraries of the Bodleian, looking at ancient manuscripts, looking at the primary texts, the primary sources, the secondary sources, looking through all of the arguments against the resurrection of Jesus. And in that process, first, we became Christian thinkers. We now love God with all our heart, mind, and soul. But also, emerging out of that was the vision for my life to replicate other Christian thinkers. So that's why I'm part of Prestonwood as the pastor of apologetics and cultural engagement. That's why I minister through Christian Thinkers Society, our national ministry, where we do events for pastors and Christians that want to go deeper in their faith, and why we create content like this for the church. So I love it. It's been a brilliant journey, but it didn't stop there. It ended in Israel with the actual looking at the remains, looking at the material culture. A lot of people don't realize what a young science biblical archaeology is. It's only been around for about 150 years, and it's fascinating when you look at all of the digs happening in the land of Israel. When you look at most of the archaeologists, many of which are agnostic, by the way, they do have 6 books that they use, Pat, in these archaeological digs. They use Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the book of Acts, and then the 6th one is the Flavius Josephus. So even though they may be agnostic in their personal life, they use those 6 sources to make sure they're digging in the right spot. So what does that tell you about the truth, the reliability, and the validity of the scriptures?
What do all those archaeological digs produce, and what do they mean to us?
Yeah, that's so important. I love studying this. I'm not an archaeologist, but I'm telling you, my best friends are archaeologists, literally. Archaeology helps us when we look at the material culture. We can actually see the culture, the lifestyle, the way in which people actually lived in the different stratums, that is the different eras that people live. So when we look at a first century site in Jerusalem and we uncover a crucified man by the name of Yehohanan, who still has the nail, the crucifixion nail in the heel bone, and he's in an ossuary, which means he was properly buried. It means that he wasn't buried in a mass criminal pit. His body wasn't eaten by dogs, as some scholars try to suggest. No, his body was actually buried properly, even though he's a criminal, and he was buried under the reign of Pontius Pilate. So, wow, do you realize all of the layers I just gave to our audience right there that shows that the way Jesus was buried, the entire juridical procedure that we see playing out. In fact, we understand from the archaeology that if the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish council, condemned someone to death, it was on the Sanhedrin. It was the Sanhedrin's responsibility to bury them. Well, what do we see play out in the Gospels? 2 members of the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, asked for the body. Again, it's all consistent with what we see that archaeology offers us. And so here's the interesting thing about Christianity. Unlike any other religion in the world, Christianity sources itself in truth. It sources itself in reality. Unlike all the other religions in the world, Christianity puts itself to a historical test and said, hey, Christianity is here because of a event, because of a fact of history that Jesus came alive after death. It was indisputable. And friends, one thing that all of the scholars agree on, these early disciples of Jesus all had experiences of seeing him alive after he was dead. And friends, after 40 days of those appearances, between the resurrection and ascension. And then when you lop in the Apostle Paul with that as well on the road to Damascus, we see that these individuals took this message of hope and they turned, as Acts says, the world upside down for Christ's kingdom.
Jeremiah, you've got about 30 seconds. What do you want people to take from your book and this discussion?
What I want you to take from my new book, Body of Proof, is more than two dozen times in the New Testament, the promise that's given to you with more frequency than any other promise is the promise of John 14:19. Because he lives, you will live also. Mm-hmm. And that is the beauty of the resurrection. That's the living hope that we're promised from 1 Peter 1, verse 3.
Jeremiah Johnston, president of Christian Thinkers Society, has written the book, Body of Proof, The 7 Best Reasons to Believe in the Resurrection of Jesus and Why It Matters Today. He has been our guest, and what a guest. We've got more. Stay with us here on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. You're listening to AM 990 and FM 101.5 The Word in Orlando. We'll be right back.
More of the Pat Williams Hour in just a moment. AM 990 and FM 101.5 The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour, AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word. Now, here's Pat.
Jeremiah Johnston, our guest in that first segment, talking about his book, Body of Proof. Had a wonderful visit with Jeremiah Johnston, and now we head from Dallas out to Olympia, Washington. Lauren K. Johnson, we found her. Writing consultant with Grub Street, editor at the Wrath-Bearing Tree, the book, The Fine Art of Camouflage. Lauren, welcome to Orlando. It's so nice to catch up with you.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. I wish I was actually in Orlando in person. I'm sure it's much warmer there.
Well, it's in the 80s, Lauren, so you probably don't want to hear about that, but that's okay. That's okay. Tell me about your book.
So The Fine Art of Camouflage is my memoir, which focuses on my experience in the military. I was an Air Force public affairs officer and served in Afghanistan for 9 months between 2009 and 2010, and focused on really communication while I was there. My job was essentially to share information about what was happening with the public, the international public, as well as the Afghan public, and, to filter that information to some extent, to put out talking points and key messages and the stories that we wanted the public to hear. And the book also goes into my mother's experience. She was an Army Reserve nurse and served in the first Gulf War. So kind of looks at the stories that I heard about that experience and the stories that I saw through the media and Hollywood about what it meant to be in the military and what our understanding of war was at the time when I joined shortly after 9/11. So while it's a military book and it is a memoir, it really focuses on how we're shaped as young people and as maybe not so young people, just by all of the different information that we're hearing from different sources, which, obviously has different shades of gray and nothing is the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Lauren, your book breaks down into four parts. Part one, you write about Combat Barbie, Inheritance of War, Home Sweet FOB. Not in Kansas anymore. Solidish ground. Tell us about part one of your book.
So part one is introducing you to me, a.k.a. Combat Barbie, which was my call sign when I was in Afghanistan. So that's what my teammates used on the radio when they wanted to get a hold of me. And that name comes from an incident at training. I did 3 months of training with the Army prior to deploying to be prepared for our primary mission, which was not combat. It was more bureaucratic mission, more interpersonal relations and nation building, counterinsurgency. But we had to be prepared for combat engagement if it came to it. So 3 months of training focused on cultural preparation and, you know, how to work with the locals and also the combat element. And one of the training exercises we did was a clearing a plywood village in preparation for, you know, if heaven forbid, worst comes to worst, and we are going door to door to try to clear a space of enemy insurgents. Thankfully, that's not training that I had to use. But during this training exercise, I had the good fortune of busting through a booby-trapped door and getting spewed with pink paint. And that led my teammates to dub me Combat Barbie because I looked, you know, rather rosy after that. So that's kind of how the book begins. It's thrusting you into my experience at training and kind of seeing myself not so much as a city girl, as a woman, as a public affairs officer, but as a soldier, kind of being indoctrinated through this experience.
Lauren, how would you describe the nation of Afghanistan to those of us, obviously, who have never been there? And should we still be a presence there?
Oh, goodness. Well, the nation is very complicated. It's by virtue of geography, you know, a very mountainous region, and that kind of feeds into the structure of governance or lack thereof that they've historically had. You know, it's very tribal-based society, and you get pockets of populations in, you know, valleys and different low ground areas, and all separated just by geography. And there's, you know, many, many, many different ethnic groups who more or less keep to themselves. So, you know, in a lot of ways, when with the Operation Enduring Freedom and the efforts to install a democratic government, it just was an extreme challenge in an environment that had not wasn't really conducive to a democratic setup because of their geography and their tribal history and allegiances to family and local community first and foremost. So just a very, very complicated situation.
Tell us about the religions of that country. What did you learn?
Not as much as I would have liked to while I was there. I was in a more conservative part of the country in Paktia province, in the southeastern part of the country. And it was a more religious area where they had a lot of, you know, religious schools. When we spoke with the local communities, we were speaking with their religious leaders because they were, you know, in leadership positions and more or less, you know, relayed information to their populace and were involved in making the decisions for those communities. A big Muslim population, and mm-hmm. You know, we heard the call to prayers, and you know, we had locals who worked as interpreters for our team and would abide by Muslim customs. We celebrated the breaking of the fast with them during Ramadan. So it was an interesting position to be interacting directly with the locals. And that was, you know, some of my most rewarding parts of my experience were being able to have those conversations, not necessarily with the government officials or the people in power, but just the, you know, everyday men. And by virtue of being a woman, I could speak to the women of Afghanistan as well and learning about their culture. I certainly wish I could have learned more.
Lauren K. Johnson has authored the book, The Fine Art of Camouflage. She's in Olympia, Washington. Part two of your book, Lauren, you write about outside the wire and fear smells like chi. Waiting too is hell. Ballots and bullets and kebabs. I want to hear all about this.
So part two is really, you know, I'm in Afghanistan at this point and experiencing some of the missions that my team is involved in. I went out to the governor's compound in the city near where our base was. And, you know, a suicide bombing had taken place there just a week prior. We were gearing up for the presidential election in 2009 in Afghanistan. So that's where the ballots and bullets and kebabs comes into play. You know, that was a big focus of the U.S. government in 2009 was trying to help that election go smoothly for the Afghan people. Unfortunately, it did not go so smoothly and was, you know, riddled with corruption and fraud and voter intimidation that really kind of threatened the legitimacy of the election. So that was kind of one of my first experiences that clashed very harshly with my expectations of what my experience would be like in Afghanistan, you know, just realizing it was much more complicated than I had realized.
Part three, ballots and bullets and kebabs again. And then you write about the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth and the Potemkin village. What's going on here?
So as we get through the book and into part three, that's kind of where I'm starting to experience more of those disillusioning incidents. So my role in public affairs and my job title in Afghanistan was information operations officer. So as I mentioned, I was kind of the mouthpiece for what was going on in my area. And some of those things that were happening in part three were, you know, the stories that were coming out in the media were not necessarily positive toward the American presence in Afghanistan. And I was in a position where part of my job was to try to remedy that and put out some positive news stories. So, for example, we had a detainee who was being released from Bagram prison come through our base, and his release was a compassionate release because he was ill and was going to go spend his remaining time with his family. So my job was to, you know, kind of exploit that compassionate decision made by the American government and interview the detainee. But what came out in the interview was that he didn't know why he was captured in the first place. And we edited that out before it played on the Afghan radio. So decisions like that and, you know, kind of starting to wrestle with my public affairs alter ego versus, you know, what I felt in my heart was the right thing to do. And just, you know, that push and pull that you have to kind of squash to some extent when you're in an environment like a war zone, because the focus really needs to be on, you know, everyday survival.
My guest from Olympia, Washington, Lauren K. Johnson. We got more with Lauren talking about her book, The Fine Art of Camouflage. This is the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. So glad you're with us here on AM 990 and FM 101.5 The Word in Orlando. We'll be right back.
More of the Pat Williams Hour in just a moment. AM 990 and FM 101.5 The Word. You're listening to the Pat Williams Power Hour. AM 990 and FM 101.5 The Word. Now, here's Pat.
Lauren K. Johnson is talking about her career in the military, the fine art of camouflage. Lauren, I am always intrigued by the role of the chaplains in the military, and where they fit and how important they are. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. I mean, I can certainly explain it from my perspective.
Sure.
So I interacted with chaplains both where I was stationed in the States, actually down in Florida on the Panhandle, in the Fort Walton Beach area. And then there was a chaplain on the small forward operating base where I was in Afghanistan as well. And I went to church at that time in my life. I considered myself a religious person and really kind of found solace in that space. And, you know, it was a very small base where I was stationed in Afghanistan, and you know, loud, and kind of the sounds and the sights of war were everywhere. So we had this little white chapel with, I think, like three rows of pews, and you put your guns in the gun rack when you enter the chapel. But despite being, you know, so obviously, you know, in the midst of a war zone, it had this semblance of peace about it, and it kind of became a sanctuary. So the chaplains were, you know, kind of served that role to give deployed service members a space to, you know, find a different kind of fellowship and a little reprieve from the chaos around you and a chance to just commune together. The kind of less warm, fuzzy side of that is that the chaplains play an important role in casualty notifications. And I do address one of those in my book as well. Shortly after I got back from Afghanistan, I had a friend who was killed in Afghanistan in an aircraft crash. And worked with a chaplain in that capacity, making sure that the families were notified before information got out through the media or through the grapevine from other folks who knew what had happened. It's a very, if you've seen it in you know, Hollywood movie, actually bring the connection to We Were Soldiers, a Vietnam War era film starring Mel Gibson, where casualty notification is a component of that. And it is like that in the sense that it's a very, you know, structured, deliberate method of doing things, because it's obviously a very delicate situation, and there's a chaplain and a family friend who goes to, you know, every porch to make sure that folks are as comfortable as they can be in that, you know, unfathomable situation.
Lauren, part four of your book, The Quiet Season, Collateral Damage, The Fog of War, The End. Tell us about part four.
I like how you say that. It sounds so dramatic. The End. So part four is really the conclusion of my time in Afghanistan, which ended with a series of difficult events. This was back in spring of 2010, and during that time, there was the CIA attack at a neighboring province. If you've seen the movie Zero Dark Thirty, the informant that the CIA meets with to hopefully learn about bin Laden's whereabouts, and it ends up being an insider attack, and seven CIA agents are killed. That happened while I was in Afghanistan in the province next to mine, where the team that performed the same mission mine did was based. So obviously hit us all very hard, and kind of those ripple effects just lasted for the rest of the deployment. Then we had a suicide bombing at a base in our province, and an information cover-up in our province. So this was kind of, you know, the swell of things that surrounded the end of my deployment. And then I returned home, which gets into the last part of the book, part five, where I just felt very disoriented. And, you know, what do I do with all of this stuff that I just went through? And I don't know how I feel about it. And how do I know who I am anymore and what I'm doing with my life, basically.
Part five. Home, in quotes, death, crossroads, war and peace of mind, one step at a time, and then welcome to the real world. Explain all that, Lauren.
Yeah, so that follows me home from Afghanistan and just the very disorienting experience of being inserted back into life that has been, you know, moving on for a year without me, and realizing that I don't know how to do that. I have a conversation at a restaurant with family and my brother's girlfriend's family where they're asking, you know, what was my experience like? And I just don't know how to explain that. I mean, here we are 13 years later, and I still feel like I ramble when I'm talking about it. There's just so much. It's not something that I could capture in my public affairs training to, you know, fit in a tidy soundbite. So I just, like, rambled, and my brain went crazy and just spewed random facts about Afghanistan and started getting into politics and just, you know, didn't understand anymore how to have a normal conversation. And I had been, I'd missed a year of pop culture, so I didn't know any of the music or the movies that people were talking about. I heard Justin Bieber for the first time and thought he was a woman. So just this period of extreme disorientation, and which is something that, you know, everyone goes through to some extent when they've been whether deployed with the military or in a different place and deals with that kind of, you know, culture shock of returning. And as the book concludes, just kind of trying to, you know, reconcile that and figure out my next steps. And that comes, unfortunately, with that incident of my friend being killed. My grandfather also was diagnosed with cancer when I was deployed and ended up passing away shortly after my return. So a lot of, you know, external things that weren't directly related to my deployment, but that brought up these feelings about, you know, trying to understand everything I was going through when, you know, looking at someone was killed in Afghanistan, you know, what role did I play in that as this information operations officer, you know, essentially trying to continue support for that war. My grandfather had served in the Korea era, and you know, I learned more about his experience as he was on his deathbed and learned that it wasn't, you know, necessarily the rose-colored view that I had of it growing up. And eventually I started talking with my mom and realizing that all of the stories that I've heard about her experience in the military weren't the full story either. So it kind of served as an opportunity for all of us to just really get real with each other and, you know, just kind of acknowledge that that war is an extremely complicated thing. And it's, you know, at its core, a human experience, and it's impossible as a human not to be affected by it.
Lauren K. Johnson is our guest. The book, The Fine Art of Camouflage. What does that title mean, The Fine Art of Camouflage? I've been trying to think what that means.
So it's obviously camouflage has a meaning in the military. You know, it refers to the uniforms and the tradition of, you know, blending in, and you know, also kind of glossing over, you know, who you are as an individual. You become part of a unit in the military. And I think as young people coming of age, we do similar things and we try to, you know, adjust ourselves and be what other people want us to be to some extent. And we shape ourselves into this persona based on our expectations of what other people want and what we want ourselves to be. So the fine art of camouflage refers to the ways that I did that. And this, the storytelling that I mentioned that, you know, shapes how we see ourselves and what we say about ourselves to ourselves and to other people and the stories we hear. And all of this kind of gets cobbled together into the perspective of how we view the world. But it's, you know, not a pure perspective by any means.
Lauren, what is your advice to young women, particularly, who may be thinking about going into the military for a part of their early years? What do you tell them?
Oh, that's a great question. I have two daughters of my own who are young. They're twins who are almost two now. So I have a few years before I need to broach that subject with them. But in general, I would never discourage someone from making that decision. I got a lot out of my military experience, even though I did, you know, have some not so positive things in my time. I also learned a lot and grew a lot as a person, and, you know, had an experience worth writing a book about. So I definitely wouldn't turn someone away. I would just encourage them to educate themselves and get as informed as possible about what the military is really like, not just what the recruiter says or what you see in Hollywood, but talk to people who are serving in different capacities or who have served, and you know, read about the experiences of people who served and get up to speed on current politics and the situation throughout the world, because so much can change so quickly. And it's just a lot to take in as a young person in the moment. And you don't really have a chance when you're in the midst of it to, you know, ponder the greater social, political, psychological implications of everything. So thinking about those nuances before you make that decision can be really, really informative.
Lauren K. Johnson has been our guest. The Fine Art of Camouflage. Fascinating story. We're so glad that you had time to join us here on the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. Jeremiah Johnston, our first guest. And then Lauren K. Johnson had joined us to top off this hour. We'll see you next weekend, folks, for the Pat Williams Saturday Power Hour. Stay tuned all day long to AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word in Orlando. You'll be better off for it. God bless you. We'll see you next weekend.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the Pat Williams Power Hour. Join us again next week at this time, where faith comes by hearing. AM 990 and FM 101.5, The Word.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.